Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I've been telling you guys for months now, this administration's terrible for organized workers. From virtually having instant decertification votes to ending what had always been kind of somewhat an even playing field for stewards and management when talking about a worker's grievance or something having to do with a worker on the job. All this stuff is being smashed. I mean, we're talking 70 plus years of precedent just being tossed out the window. The pendulum swinging way, way too far to the side of management. And the thing is, when the pendulum wasn't this far, their dirty tricks and their tactics almost never got called out. And my next guest is a longtime union organizer who's written a couple of books here about his experiences. Back in 2017, he wrote The Jackson Project, War in the American Workplace, and most recently, his story about the union-busting campaign, which took place at Mohawk Industry. The book's titled Fighting Union Busters in a Carolina Carpet Mill. Phil Cohen, thanks for taking time for us.
And thank you. Glad to be back, Rick.
So, you're one of the guys that, I've followed for a while. Your Jackson Project book was fantastic. You're one of the guys on the front lines that's fighting every day to keep what little power workers have in the workplace. And again, this is another one of these tales of, the little guy fighting the good fight. And in this case, actually coming out okay.
Yeah, that's right. This was this was kind of a classic David and Goliath battle. And to kind of lead your audience into it, I retired full-time from the union in 2011. But my title was Special Projects Coordinator, and my role was to go into hot situations that most folks couldn't handle. When going by the book just didn't work anymore, and doing what I had to do to bring the union out on top by any means necessary. And one of the areas in which I had a great deal of experience was successfully fighting professional union busters. So between 2011 and 17, I wrote the Jackson Project and went through the process of, promoting the book and what normally happens after you write a book. In November of 2017, the union asked me to come out of retirement and investigate and expose an illegal union busting plot by Mohawk Industries, which is a Fortune 500 company, at its carpet mill in Eden, North Carolina, a place where we'd had a local for around 80 years. And despite my experience, almost as soon as my boots hit the ground, I encountered a whole new playing field. I mean, just a whole new set of rules like nothing I had ever dealt with, and I'd been through some very, very vicious deserts before. The company naturally had hired, a high-profile union-busting law firm. This particular attorney's name was Frederick Engelhart, and he used a tactic I had never seen before. Normally an NLRB case is, investigated and adjudicated at a regional level.
Right.
And, my case, it's the regional office in Winston-Salem. And the five-person panel that governs the NLRB doesn't really get involved unless the losing party at the regional level appeals. But in this case, the company attorney almost immediately, once he saw that we were really getting witnesses to come forward and presenting some really damning evidence against Mohawk Industries, he began filing his 50-page briefs directly to the NLRB in Washington, asking that our evidence be thrown out on obscure legal technicalities, not trying to rebut the quality of the evidence itself, but doing the same thing that a lawyer, for John Gotti would have done, saying, forget whether or not he killed somebody. These legal technicalities mean we shouldn't consider the evidence.
Yeah, and I got to think that had everything to do with, in D.C. you have a stacked NLRB. You got Trump's NLRB, so you're going to go there to the friendly court.
Yeah, that's right. And, look, I've dealt with the NLRB under every administration since George Bush Sr. And the NLRB, for those of your in your audience who are not fully familiar with it, It was established by Franklin Roosevelt as part of the New Deal as supposedly a neutral agency to adjudicate issues and potential labor law violations between unions and companies. And naturally, you know, if you had a Republican in office, it swung a little bit to the right. You had a Democrat in office, it swung a little bit to the left. But all said and done, it remained a reasonably neutral agency bound by our system of checks and balances. But the Trump NLRB has been appointed with the unique role of simply pulling the agency's teeth and dismantling the very laws that it's set to interpret and defend.
Right.
And the other interesting part of this situation is that the National Right to Work Committee inserted itself into the process within the first couple of months. They became the attorneys representing the anti-union petitioner. And they and the company's attorney petitioned the NLRB to use our situation as a test case to repeal the very laws upon which our case was based, and upon which every victory over a decertification that I've had over the decades has been based. So that's really the purpose of the Trump NLRB. And we had to really put on a monumental case to take them on.
No, and I remember back, you know, 2017, 2018, I think we actually had people on back then talking about this and what was going on down there, because you know, I remember it, you know, it was right around Super Bowl time, if I'm not mistaken. I remember this, and I remember at the time going, you know, this is going to be bad, because this is setting that thing in line that's going to allow the Trump administration to just wipe out, you know, every 70 years of precedence, and again have the pendulum swing to the extreme, which is why we're seeing these decisions, I think, coming out of the NLRB now, especially around decert votes and changing what had, you know, had been the precedent for decades.
Yep, that's exactly right. I mean, Trump is in essence waging a war of genocide against the American labor movement. He's not trying to restrict the American labor movement, he's trying to destroy it.
Yeah.
But then what do you expect, because he is an icon of corporate America?
But here's the thing that gets me, Phil.
It's astonishing how many working people voted for an icon of corporate America.
No, this is where I was going. I mean, the sad reality is a lot of union people, I know a lot of union folks who voted for him and are diehard supporters of his, because they don't believe what you're saying. They don't believe that that the administration is being overly hostile to organized workers. They don't believe that they're any worse than say the Obama administration was. Because immediately when I start saying, you know, they've done this, this is exactly how it, you know, the stewards thing, for instance. I mean, they're in the GM decision, they are changing what can happen in a meeting between labor and management, between.
Right.
The pendulum is swinging, and I get people telling me that's not actually happening.
Listen, I'll tell you my personal opinion, and I view everything from the perspective of people. Because, you know, I'm a boots-on-the-ground soldier, and at the end of the day,
right,
it all comes down to people against people. Working people are, to be more accurate about it, a certain breed of working people identify with Trump because he comes across as a tough guy. They like his machismo.
Yeah, yeah.
Truth is, he's a daddy-bought rich kid. He never got dirt under his fingernails 1 minute in his life. But nonetheless, he's got this tough guy image, and certain working people identify with that. And it's really unfortunate. But I'll tell you something. The single largest demographic in the United States is gullible, ignorant people. I mean, you know, people in Europe, I've done a lot of traveling, and, you know, folks in Europe are just absolutely dumbfounded by the level of gullibility and willful ignorance that a significant number of the American people have, and it was just enough to get Trump elected the first time. I'm hoping it will be not quite enough to get him reelected next month.
No, I fear this latest COVID stunt, which I'm viewing as a stunt at this point, will then solidify that tough guy image, and and make this a lot closer race than people want to believe it is. And the fear is, as I said at a speech I gave the other day, 4 more years of Donald Trump in the White House, the labor movement will basically be illegal.
And you're right about that. I mean, that's where he wants to go with this. He's already brought out, you know, kind of the rhetoric from the 1920s that the labor movement is a threat to national security. I mean, I've spent 30 years presenting cases to federal agents, enforcing federal law, but now suddenly I'm a threat to national security.
So I'm looking at this, Phil, because, you know, the sad reality is, and getting back to your book, where, you know, this victory you guys had just a couple of short years ago, I don't know is possible in this day. So, you know, it seems to me that the attacks are going to be coming more frequently from these big companies as they try and shed their organized workers and you know, take us back to poverty, wages, and desperation conditions. I shouldn't pose it as a statement, but as a question. Do you see that? Do you see this victory you guys had just a couple of years ago as something going forward would be even possible?
It would be more difficult given recent NLRB decisions. Now, every desert that I've defeated, and I have defeated, I have never had a union locally certified on my watch. And in every case, it was the blocking charge policy enacted several months after Roosevelt created the NLRB, which essentially says that if there is a decertification petition in the works or already been filed, but the union can present compelling evidence, like a prima facie case of illegal management involvement, the election is put on hold until the charges are investigated. And if those charges are found to have merit, the petition is thrown out. And the blocking charge policy, which they were unsuccessful in using the Mohawk situation as the basis to repeal, has since been repealed. And it means that even if the union has compelling evidence of management involvement, the election takes place anyway. But then the ballots aren't counted until the charges are adjudicated.
Right.
But what that does is it leaves a local in a state of flux, possibly for years. Do we or don't we have a union? If for some reason, especially under, you know, an ongoing Trump NLRB were that to be the case, unions start losing more and more meritorious cases, and then the ballots do get counted, some of those people who voted are going to be people who were successfully intimidated by management. And there was one of our lawyers pointed out during the campaign itself, when these changes were already afoot, that a study at a major university show that if somebody is coerced into doing something they don't want to do, they rationalize it by ending up changing sides and supporting the coercing party so they can simply feel, you know, good about themselves, meaning somebody whose arm is twisted to sign a decertification petition is much more likely to vote in an election against the union simply to maintain a consistency with what they were forced to do.
Right, kind of like a workplace Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. You got it in a nutshell.
And these are illegal activities that these employers do. And look, you know, I've seen these things happen over the years, where, you know, in your case it was extreme. They were, you know, out and out blatant about it. You know, as I understand, they actually let a couple of workers just, you know, not work anymore and just go around free flowing.
They paid actually like 5 or 6 workers. Their job was to go around the plant and solicit signatures. You know, imagine if, you know, a local union officer went into another department and tried to sign a union card. If he didn't get fired, he'd be suspended. And yet these people were paid to do that. Beyond that, they were actually, one of them, the petitioner, would actually sometimes come to work in business clothes and sit in the front office, and people would get instructed by their supervisor to go up to the front office and meet with her. Beyond that, I mean, you know, the capital offense of union busting is management directly soliciting signatures.
Right.
And we implicated three members of management, one of them from the corporate office, in repeated cases of directly soliciting signatures. And what was astonishing about the testimony here is that, you know, they naturally went after people that they thought would be weak links and wouldn't come forward. Meaning, you know, this is North Carolina, it's in the right to work heart of the world. And so they went after non-members. And they pushed some, and the trick was we actually got some of these non-members to come forward and testify. I presented more non-members in this NLRB case than in my entire career put together. And they just underestimated their people. They pissed some people off so deeply with just the extent of their strong-arm coercion that even though they weren't members of the union, we were able to convince them to come forward.
That speaks volumes. And all this stuff is in the book, Fighting Union Busters in a Carolina Carpet Mill. You can find this if you go to fightingunionbusters.org. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at the and get a copy of the book, because I think these are stories that we, at this, especially in this moment, Phil, these are stories that I think the working class of this country really has to absorb, because I think the pendulum is going to continue to swing a little bit for some time. And I think it's going to take a much more militant working class to stand up, step forward, and speak out, as these heroic folks did at the Mohawk Industries plant, for this pendulum to begin to swing back.
Yeah,
even if Joe Biden is elected, even if we get a Democratic Congress and a Democratic Senate and House and all of that, the pendulum is still on the side of employers right now.
Trump and NLRB dominated by Trump appointees for another 18 months. And just to add something, the book's available wherever people like books if they don't want to bother going to my website. It has links to all the vendors, but Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, everybody's got it. And it's a good action story. You know, there's a lot of it. There's probably more information about the inside workings of a company-sponsored decertification and how to beat it than has ever been put down in a book. It's an insider's perspective, but in the context of an entertaining, action-packed thriller that people will enjoy reading while they're educated.
No, and that's so important, especially in what I think we're coming up to in the next several months. And, you know, I've been saying for quite some time, you know, maybe things have to get so bad that the only way things get better is things have to get so bad, and we become a much more militant working class. Because look,
the thing that's really important, Rick, is somehow we got to figure out how to make the millennials wake up. And another fascinating difference about the Mohawk desert. Look, a desert is about divide and conquer. Fighting a desert is about unifying. Very simple. But normally the divide and conquer is along racial lines, especially in the South, when you'll have a higher percentage of blacks in the union than whites. Because, you know, blacks in the South see the labor movement correctly as an extension of the civil rights movement. But here, that is not where the divide was. The divide was younger workers against older workers. Their pitch to the younger workers, because they'd hired a bunch of new folks in like 2016, was that in our non-union plans, seniority means nothing. We simply choose who we think the best workers are to keep during a layoff or to promote during a job vacancy. And so if you get rid of the union, you won't have all these senior people in front of you. And with one exception, all of the people on the anti-union committee were youngsters in their 20s and 30s. And the real question is how to get through to this generation. I mean, an interesting statistic. You know, Facebook gives you really good analytics about who's responding to your posts and who's buying your book, etc. By far, the largest demographic that's been interested in my book has been people between 55 and 64. And you drop into people in their 20s and the 30s, and there's hardly any interest. because they just don't get it. They inherited what people like you and me and folks from our generation spent our lives fighting for. And they walk into the wages and the benefits and the rights and the working conditions that we fought and bled for and took enormous chances for, went to jail for, and they just take it for granted. They just don't get it, and they don't want to get it. And the real magic here, the silver bullet here, if we're going to revitalize and re-energize the labor movement, is how do we wake up the people in their 20s and 30s before all of us are gone?
And that is the question, and the hope is the beginning of it is your book, you know, Fighting Union Busters in a Carolina Carpet Mill. As I said, we'll get links out on how you can get a copy of that, fightingunionbusters.org, the website of how you can do that as well. I guess that's the million-dollar question, and something, Phil, we're going to have to pick up at another time, because obviously this isn't going to go away. Obviously something we're going to have to continue to fight for. And great book. I appreciate the time. I look forward to talking to you again, my friend.
I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Good stuff. Phil Cohen, author of Fighting Union Busters in a Carolina Mill. Make sure you check out his website, fightingunionbusters.org, and pick up a copy of the book. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.